Hey, I'm Jane Lindholm. I'm the host of Vermont Edition, and I'm just popping in to tell you that this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
I'm Peter Hirschfeld, in for Jane Lindholm, and you're listening to Vermont Edition. When Governor Phil Scott declared a state of emergency on Friday evening, Vermont knew of two confirmed cases of COVID-19 in the state. As of this afternoon, we're up to 12 now. Deputy Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan is with us today to help us understand what the state is doing to slow the spread of the disease. Deputy Commissioner Dolan, I can only fathom what the past few days have looked like for you, and we're really grateful for you joining us today.
Oh, thank you. I'm really glad to be here.
So, Deputy Commissioner Dolan, on Friday, we had two known cases of COVID-19 in Vermont. On Saturday, that number was 5. By Sunday, we were up to 8. And I gather Health Commissioner Mark Levine announced that the latest figure is now 12. Tell us what you know at this point about what that growth curve is going to look like in the coming days and weeks.
So we do have 12 now. 8 of those are among Vermonters, and 9 of those are among non-Vermont residents. And we've tested a total of 400 and about 22 so far. And we expect that this number will go up. What we really learned over the weekend, so we do contract tracing in order to investigate and find out where the infection is coming from, what kind of risk factors people have when they result in a positive test. And what we found over the weekend is that we had more cases where people didn't have an obvious risk factor, like travel from one of the affected countries or contact with a confirmed case. And so because we're seeing less of that, that confirmed that we have community transmission, and it really triggered us to put more social distancing mitigation measures in place.
So do you have any sense at this point? Are there mathematical models that you're looking at, looking at other states, what the growth curve has looked like there? I mean, do we know at this point or have even a guesstimate of what numbers are going to be a week from now?
I mean, we're seeing estimates anywhere from 20 to 40% of the population eventually possibly becoming infected with COVID-19. We don't know what that's going to look like in Vermont. I think we did get in somewhat early. We've been trying to do some containment, and now getting early with these social mitigation measures, we're really hopeful that we don't follow the trajectory that we've seen in some other countries, for example, Italy, and I know that place is getting a lot of the press. So we're hoping that some of these measures help. And of course, the most important thing that people can do, and I know we say it a lot, is wash hands and stay home when you're sick. Those two measures alone can go very far. And then the mass gatherings, gathering in large groups, of course, avoiding that really helps protect others from becoming infected and slows down the transmission. But any guess at what the exponential growth is going to look like in Vermont really would be a guess at this point.
You mentioned, Deputy Commissioner Dolan, social distancing, washing hands, all these things we've been hearing about from both the Department of Health and the CDC. How do we know that that's actually helping reduce the spread when, as you mentioned, we're seeing cases pop up in Vermont where people did not travel out of state, where people did not necessarily come into contact with an individual that's known to have COVID-19?
Well, there is a pretty significant body of literature on pandemic science, and we have epidemiologists here and others who are schooled in this area. We developed and conducted our own literature review in the last 2 weeks to help inform the decisions we're making now. As well, we have colleagues at the CDC that we've worked with for years through other administrations, and those senior folks are also working on these measures and the modeling and the science behind it. So we are doing our best with the best science that we have. Obviously, we don't know everything about this virus. We don't know how transmissible it is. We know it's transmissible when you're symptomatic, and we believe it's more transmissible when you're symptomatic. We don't know a lot about the transmission when you're asymptomatic. So we don't know everything about how it behaves, but based on what we know about pandemics in general, we're able to do some things and put measures in place. But this is obviously unprecedented in many, many years in this country.
Deputy Commissioner Dolan, we got an email from Sean who said he had flown to Colorado 2 weeks ago, had layovers in New York City, came back with a mild and irregular shortness of breath that lasted about 5 days. He said he was denied twice by his healthcare provider for a COVID-19 test. He says he feels fine now, but that his partner has some of those same symptoms he had. He wants to know, why can't people with mild symptoms get a test for COVID-19, given the fact that we are now starting to see this community spread?
It's a great question, and thank you. And I'm glad that he's feeling better, and I'm sorry that his partner or roommate is not feeling better now. So I would say that it's important to know that we have been able to test everyone in Vermont who has been medically referred for testing, and so anyone who's been deemed appropriate for testing has been tested in Vermont thus far. However, there is a nationwide shortage of tests and test supplies for this particular virus, and we've been working very hard. We've got a great partnership now with UVM and others to be able to ramp up or at least continue the level of testing that we're doing. But we do face supply shortages, and we do need to be careful and use those resources in the best way possible. And right now that means using those resources to test those who are medically referred to us by our providers here in Vermont.
Is there a light at the end of that tunnel, Deputy Commissioner Tolan, that testing shortage tunnel? I mean, we're hearing about several hospitals across the state and clinics that are working to stand up drive-through test sites. I'm presuming their existence won't be of much use unless we do see testing capacity increase. So is there any sense at this point that that shortage is going to alleviate, and if so, when?
Our partnership with UVM so far has been going well. I talked to Dr. Stephen Loeffler yesterday, president at UVMMC, and he believes that we should have a good supply in the next 3 and 4 weeks. And hopefully, as more and more private labs come online, and they will be, commercial labs will be coming online this week, it will allow us to be able to expand testing. Right now, our goal is to test those who best meet the criteria and who are already sick. But hopefully in the coming weeks, we may be able to expand that testing somewhat. But right now, we are encouraging people with mild symptoms to stay home until they're better, recognizing that in some of those cases, those people may have COVID-19 and we may not have any way to surveil them at this time.
I want to bring in Stuart from Essex, who's calling us now. Hi, Stuart.
Hello. My question is, what opportunities or call to action are there for people who want to help assist in any of the ways possible? I am not a trained medical professional, but I'd really like to volunteer in any ways that I can. Is the best thing I can do to isolate, or is there anything I can help with in the greater community?
Thank you for the call, Stuart. You know, Deputy Commissioner Dolan, I am seeing so much of this on social media, a real appetite among Vermonters to find some way where they can help address this issue or help their neighbors. What can people who aren't doctors, who aren't on the front lines of the COVID-19 response in the healthcare universe do either to mitigate the spread or to help people that have contracted COVID?
No, I appreciate the question, and I think there are a lot of opportunities, particularly because we're asking people who are elderly to stay home and to do more isolation. There will be people who are vulnerable, who may not have a lot of resources, who will have needs. And so right now, the Department of Aging and Independent Living is talking to the areas, the area agencies on aging to set up a stronger system for meal delivery. So you can reach out to your local agency on aging to find out if there are volunteer opportunities there. I know a lot of towns are setting up internal volunteer lists to just do checking on neighbors. I know that we will be looking at childcare for healthcare workers, and I don't know if some of those opportunities may be available to people in the community who might be able to volunteer to provide some childcare. Again, we're encouraging people with social distancing, but we're also balancing that with the needs of our community, and those are some of the needs. There will need to be some contact with other folks, and checking in on your neighbors, particularly if they're elderly, particularly if they're vulnerable, I think is an important thing to do. Again, be aware of the symptoms that you may have or others may have, and keep your distance where possible, but I think checking in is an important role, and hopefully you can reach out to your local town administrators and learn a little bit more about what they might be doing in terms of setting up volunteer mechanisms.
We've learned, Deputy Commissioner Dolan, that a number of the confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Vermont involve people who don't actually reside here. And a number of these people are folks who live in Massachusetts, New York, who had decamped to their second homes in Vermont, presumably to avoid some of the outbreaks in places like New Rochelle that we've seen, New York. I know Commissioner Mark Levine has said that this is sort of a theme or a trend that the department has noticed. How does that complicate mitigation efforts for Vermont?
Well, you know, we take care of anyone who's here. And we've seen the same in other neighboring states where we may have Vermonters there in the past when we've had outbreaks of other illnesses and they've been taken care of. So as much as I know people may feel a little frustrated that our resources are being strained by people from neighboring states, we also recognize that anyone who's here is here for the care that we can provide, and we'll do that.
Julie from St. Johnsbury is calling in. Julie, what's your question for Deputy Commissioner Tracy Dolan?
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I live in a building with 46 apartments that's age 55 and older. We're not assisted living. We have lots of people in and out all day in this building. What can we do to protect each other from this traffic that's coming into our building? Thank you.
And I'll let you handle that one, Deputy Commissioner Dolan.
Sure. Well, I don't know if building code is my background, but I can say from a public health perspective, some people are utilizing screening questions as people visit facilities. So they're asking three questions. They're asking, have you recently returned from a high-risk country? Have you been in contact with a confirmed case? And are you exhibiting any of the following symptoms? And those would be symptoms like fever, cough, or shortness of breath. And so some facilities are doing that. I don't know if you're allowed to do that in your building. I'm not sure what your regulations are, but that's one way. And then others are just really promoting, putting up signs, promoting hand washing, and encouraging people to limit visitors. I know that in our healthcare facilities, and I understand that you are not in a healthcare facility, it sounds like it's an apartment building geared toward seniors, but in healthcare facilities, they've gone much farther and restricted visitation at healthcare facilities, at long-term care facilities, so that really only essential staff and visitors are there in a few cases. So I don't have direct guidance in terms of what you're allowed to do in your building, but certainly talking amongst each other and determining the best way to limit contact with a lot of other people and to encourage that social distancing would be one way to go.
Deputy Commissioner Dolan, today the governor gave an updated executive order related to gatherings. On Friday, he issued an order banning gatherings of more than 250 people. Today, that number is down to 50 people, I assume based on CDC guidance that went out on Sunday. That restriction, though, does not apply to grocery stores, bus stations, airports. But are those places we should be avoiding too? I mean, what about even like going to get a cup of coffee at a general store? Is that no longer advisable?
You know, we're not going so far as to recommend exactly where people should or shouldn't go. What we're trying to stick with is the principles of social distancing, and the principle is to maintain a good distance from one another, at least 6 feet, to be aware of your own symptoms, to be aware of other symptoms, and to not have prolonged close contact. We need grocery stores, and I'd really like to encourage people to stop hoarding. You're hurting your neighbors. You're hurting the elderly who aren't going to be going in and buying 10 pallets of toilet paper. You're hurting your neighbors who don't have the resources to buy all of that in advance. Grocery stores, to the best of our knowledge, will be staying open. They're essential. Areas that are required for travel are continuing to stay open. And so, again, it's about limiting your time. Certainly go in and leave quickly and try to allow for some distance. But get the supplies that you need and really think about your fellow Vermonters. I know Vermonters are so good at taking care of each other, and we just have to really remind ourselves that when we're taking that last package off of a shelf, who's coming next?
Lucy from South Hero is on the phone. Lucy, what's your question?
Well, so I have a question regarding your plan for elective studies and procedures such as screening mammography. As a physician, I've seen what's been going around the country, and I know Yale, Emory, University of Utah, and Penn have canceled their screening mammograms, and then many hospitals, including the ones in Massachusetts and Omaha, University of Washington, and Cleveland Clinic, have all canceled elective procedures as well. And I'd be interested to know what your thoughts and plan are regarding that, and also Dr. Leahy as well, because certainly I've also been seeing that there have been many incidental cases coming through as a radiologist, the radiology department, in places across the country that were unexpected. And that really does put the patients at risk and then also healthcare workers. And I just wanted to know if you guys had thoughts on that and a plan in place.
I can speak broadly, and then I think I'll defer this question in more detail to Dr. Leahy. But I think this question is an excellent example of the idea that while we're battling COVID-19, there's still everything else out there that we have to do, you know? So when we close schools, that's about stopping COVID-19 spread, but also recognizing that that's a real challenge for kids who need education, who need a safe place to be. It's a challenge in terms of nutrition for children and for families. When we're asking kids to stay home, that means adults may be having to stay home and not go to work, the impact on businesses. And so, for example, at the healthcare facility, when we're flooding in with people concerned about COVID-19, rightly so, I understand that we're also putting a real strain on our other resources for other important health services. And so just recognizing that we're actually having to balance a lot here and recognizing that we're making one decision and it sometimes impacts another also very important priority. And I will defer to Leahy a little bit more later on what UVMMC is doing specifically around their elective procedures.
Tracy Dolan is the Deputy Health Commissioner for the Vermont Department of Health. I know there are lots of other demands on your time today, Deputy Commissioner, so we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
I'm Peter Hirschfeld, in for Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. COVID-19 is the disease that's caused by the new coronavirus, and it's been spreading across the globe and rapidly across the U.S. and our region now. States of emergency have been declared in all New England states. Vermont Governor Phil Scott declared his on Friday evening, and Maine's governor made the declaration on Sunday. For many, it was perhaps only in the last week that the threat and disruption of the virus hit home, and questions about social distancing, self-isolation, and consideration of quarantine became more than just abstractions. So in this portion of the show, we're going to answer your coronavirus questions with Dr. Tim Leahy, an infectious disease specialist at the University of Vermont Medical Center. Dr. Leahy, thank you for joining us today.
You bet. Looking forward to it.
I want to start, Dr. Leahy, by maybe getting to know this thing we call the coronavirus a little bit better. Take me inside your laboratory and tell me what we're seeing exactly when we look at this virus under a microscope.
So the SARS-CoV-2 is the official name of this virus. Almost seems like it's intentionally designed to be hard to remember. And this is a close relative of viruses that cause common colds in all of us in ways that we don't even know about. We get the sniffles, we feel bad for a day, and then we're fine. This one is mutated to be more deadly and just as easy to transmit. And so suddenly the common cold has become the greatest threat to humankind in 100 years.
And I mean, not – I don't need a lengthy explanation for this, but what is this virus actually doing to us once it's inside our bodies at that cellular level?
The evil trick that this virus has figured out is to connect to special molecular receptors in the lungs of our body. It makes it so that instead of being a nuisance that causes a runny nose, it can kind of burrow into the body and get into the lungs where we're supposed to be bringing in oxygen. And what happens after the virus is there is that the immune system starts to freak out, it tries to respond, and it fills the lungs up with a bunch of immune cells and, in the worst cases, even scarring of the lungs that can be quite dramatic. And so somebody who was ordinarily having no difficulty breathing doesn't have any functioning areas of the lung, and it's incredibly hard for them to get oxygen into their blood. And so the greatest danger from coronavirus has been from difficulty breathing.
Anne is calling in from Bradford. Anne, what's your question for Dr. Leahy?
Okay, I'm kind of an older woman. I'm 68, and I have allergies, so I sneeze and cough all the time. So I went to the store, and I cover up with a bandana, the nose and mouth, and I wear cotton gloves. Do you think that would help stop me getting sick or giving a germ out?
Thanks for the call, Ann. Dr. Leahy, I think we've lost count at VPR of the number of emails and Facebook questions and calls we're getting about the use of masks, whether they're any good, whether people should be buying them, whether a bandana is a suitable stand-in for a mask. What's your advice to Ann?
It's a great question. Everybody wants to know how to stay safe, particularly if they are at risk by virtue of being older or having a weakened immune system. And the best advice is actually some common sense measures that you can do. So washing your hands often is number one. And it's important to think about when you should wash your hands. This is particularly true if you are about to eat or if you've recently been out and touched public surfaces. Those are the key times, but I would kind of get in the habit of doing it regularly. The other piece is staying home as often as possible. That just helps you avoid the places where people are coughing and sneezing and getting the coronavirus on surfaces, and it helps you also avoid spreading it to other people. Unfortunately, although healthcare professionals wear masks and gloves in the hospital, I don't think that they help people out in the real world. And in fact, there's good reason to believe that they could hurt. So wearing a mask, any doctor will tell you, makes you touch your face. You can't help it. You just kind of lose track of the idea of not touching your face, and all of a sudden that thing is there and making you feel kind of claustrophobic. So you start touching it. And that's exactly not what you want, because your hands are where you're most likely to come in contact with the virus out in the world. And so what I would say is try not to go out, but when you need to go get some groceries, wash your hands regularly, don't wear a mask, and try to pay attention to what your hands are doing so you're not bringing that virus straight to your face. Same thing with gloves. Gloves are useful for a doctor going from room to room to room in the hospital, where we exit one room, wash our hands, go over to the next room, wash our hands, put on some gloves, go in, come out, take those gloves off, get new ones before the next room after washing our hands. If you're wearing the same pair of gloves over the time, they're really no better than your hands.
Bunch of questions we've been getting, Dr. Leahy, related to food. And one person said they have concerns about food since the virus can live on surfaces for several days. Should they be avoiding any produce that can't be washed in soap and then peeled? They're wondering if cooking kills the virus, or does freezing kill the virus?
It's a great question. We know that for sure that the coronavirus is in coughs and sneezes, but everybody really expects that it does transmit to people via surfaces. And so a natural question is, what about the things that I'm picking up in the grocery store? And I'd say that on one hand, that's we don't think that food is a special risk factor for getting the coronavirus, but we think that it's also no less likely to get contaminated. And so the most important take-home message there is to wash your produce when you get home and just make sure that whatever's on there is washed off. We don't know yet whether cooking or freezing the virus gets rid of it, but it can't help the virus to have those things happen. But I would just say common sense measures of washing your hands, washing your food when you your produce when you get at home, staying away from crowds are probably the things to focus on. The other stuff, they're reasonable questions, but we don't know that they really help.
We got a question on Twitter, Dr. Leahy, from Annie Marone. She says she has autoimmune concerns, and she's wondering – she's heard a lot about hand washing. She's heard a lot about social distancing. Are there other things she can be doing, steps she can be taking, whether it's nutritional, pharmaceutical, to decrease the chances that she is going to contract COVID-19?
Really, the best advice I can give for somebody who is vulnerable to getting infected with the novel coronavirus is to stay home. This is true for people who are 65 or older and people whose immune systems are weakened or people who have chronic medical conditions like chronic difficulty breathing, heart problems, etc. The best medicine is to stay home, stay away from the other people who can transmit it to you. We think that there are lots of people out there who have just a mild sniffles or don't even know they have symptoms at all who are transmitting, and it's the vulnerable people who we most worry about. So stay home, wash your hands regularly. We don't know of any particular way to strengthen the immune system beyond getting good sleep and eating well, so I don't know if vitamins or other things will help. I did want to mention one thing. Your previous caller talked about wearing a mask, and I wanted to make sure I did emphasize that there is one particular type of person out in the world who could wear a mask, and that's somebody who is sick. You know, if you have a cold, it's a great time to wear a mask because it covers your face all day long and helps you not spread it.
Jackson is calling from Orange. What question do you have for the doctor, Jackson?
Hi, Dr. Leahy. Thanks for being there. My question is, are there people that are naturally resistant to this? They're just like walking right through it and not getting sick at all, like healthcare professionals or whatever. Are there people that it just doesn't bother and just, you know, go about the normal business, doesn't touch them?
We think that there are people out there who either don't get very sick at all or don't really feel symptoms at all. The data from China suggests that 80% of people have really mild disease. And as an epidemiologist, whenever I hear that, I kind of think, well, yeah, and what about the bottom of the iceberg, the people who are fine? The real challenge is that for people who are a little more vulnerable, the consequences are so dire. So you can imagine that some healthy college kid is going out and, you know, having a beer in a bar and hanging out with friends and picking up the coronavirus probably, you know, has no threat to their health. But then they go have a school with a teacher who's over 65, or they go to church with somebody who's immune compromised, and they could spread it to somebody whose mortality rate is 1%, 5%, 10%, or even 15%. And so this is why the measures to spread us apart, not go to school, not go to churches, not go to congregational environments is so critically important.
If somebody gets infected with COVID-19, Dr. Leahy, can they become infected again?
There's no clear evidence that somebody can get COVID-19 again. There have been a couple of anecdotes out in the world of people who got sick initially from COVID-19 disease and then appeared to get worse again. They almost had a second chapter of their illness. This resembles the way sometimes some people get sick from influenza, and it made us wonder if perhaps they got a bacterial pneumonia after their COVID disease. But at this point, that's basically speculation. All we know for sure is that just about all of us can get infected, and some of us, the vulnerable among us, can get really sick.
We got an email from Pam in Plainfield, and she said she'd been reading that drinking water regularly can help prevent the virus from taking hold in one's throat because drinking often will help wash it into your digestive system where it would be killed. She wants to know, is there any truth to that?
No, we don't have any evidence to support that. It's an example of one of the theories that has been going out there in the Twitter sphere and elsewhere. And really, the scientists have not proven that at all yet. So, you know it's this interesting thing where we all want to have some control over this epidemic because it's so frightening. And at the same time, it's really important to make sure that we only trust really trustable sources. I trust the CDC website. I trust the Vermont Department of Health website. I trust Dr. Tony Fauci of the NIH. Beyond, you know, I trust the New York Times, and then I start viewing everything else with a little skepticism.
You know, I know that there are also a lot of people who are wondering if this advice that they're getting is truly going to protect them, or if this is like something designed to give us the illusion of safety and protection. We got a question on our survey from somebody who was saying they appreciate the efforts to reduce exposure as much as possible, but they've been looking at you know, these mathematical models of what the spread of the virus is looking like, and they say it just looks inevitable at this point, right? I think they're already projecting 20-40% of the U.S. population will contract the new coronavirus. They're saying if spread is ultimately inevitable and there isn't a vaccine in development, how much effort really should be put into extreme measures like self-quarantine is this something that really is going to meaningfully flatten the curve, as folks are saying?
Yeah, the answer to this question can save lives. It's a really, really important point. We believe that there's no way to protect the majority of the population from getting infected. That is true. What's even more important than that, though, is that the measures we're talking about, especially including staying home, will slow how quickly the virus spreads through the population. This is the difference between, you know, how it would happen naturally versus how it would happen if we slow it down will save thousands of lives. And so I'll explain why.
Please,
it turns out that all of the hospitals in this region and all around the world are scaling up to get ready for an essentially unprecedented number of people in their intensive care units who are having difficulty breathing as a result of this epidemic. And we're all counting up the number of artificial breathing machines we have and worried that there may or may not be enough to take care of the people who get sick. And you can imagine if we can somehow slow this virus through the population so that only a certain number of people get sick on each day, that makes it more likely that our ICUs and hospital wards will be able to have a bed for the person who really needs it. Whereas if everybody gets sick really quickly, it's going to overwhelm the hospitals. We've already seen that happen in Seattle and in Italy, and it's something we're trying really hard to stop from happening here.
Dr. Ann Young is calling from Sunapee, New Hampshire. Hello, Dr. Young.
Hi, it's Dr. Joyce Young.
I apologize.
That's okay. I'm a naturopathic physician with an area of expertise in environmental medicine, and I've just fielded a question from somebody about the issue of respiratory droplets. And since right now fragranced consumer products are releasing oil droplets that you can smell in the air, and they're pervasive in every kind of environment, and they're way beyond social distancing. And the person was asking whether the coronavirus would be able to adhere onto the fragrance oil droplets, and therefore that would be another path of transmission.
What do you think, Dr. Leahy?
You know, I think this is it's a good example of some creative thinking that people are doing to try to come up with ways of understanding this kind of scary epidemic. And at the same time that I would encourage people to be thinking, I would also say stay close to the science. The scientists have not shown any link of this virus to perfume or other odors, but they have clearly linked it to sneezing and coughing and being in crowded places. So I would say let's keep the message simple and something that we know will help people as opposed to a hypothesis that might be there. So I'd say stay away from crowds, wash your hands, and keep an eye on the news, and we'll see if the scientists really see other patterns that can empower us.
Carol is calling in from Chittenden. Carol, I gather you've been a little bit under the weather of late?
Yes, I have. I'm feeling much better. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, I am a nurse. I do some home care. I take care of a patient who is fully vented. At what point, how long should I wait when I am asymptomatic before I return to work?
I'm sorry that you haven't been feeling well, but glad things are getting better. Have you been diagnosed with COVID, or is it just more that you had a what felt like a usual respiratory tract infection?
No, I have not been diagnosed. I had a sore throat and respiratory infection. Nothing that I couldn't handle, but I was, definitely a hard cold, I would say.
Okay. Thanks for clarifying. You know, you're asking a question that is right in this gray area of our knowledge. You know, we know that for many people, the novel coronavirus gives an illness that's basically indistinguishable from a common cold. And so we're all wondering here in March when we have the sniffles, is that it? And so should I take really special precautions to protect my neighbors? And what would make it easy to answer that question would be if we had readily available tests by the thousands or actually even millions to be able to know the answer of, you know, was that coronavirus or not. And unfortunately, as you guys have heard, they're having some really serious technological barriers to getting enough tests to enough people. And so we can't know. So for people who are mildly symptomatic, what I would suggest is being a little more aggressive than you usually would be about measures you take to protect people from a cold. So, you know, definitely if you have, you're feeling ill and you have a fever, but you're okay to stay at home and don't even think about coming to work or to school until that fever is gone. And then I would say if you're still having, you know, bad sniffles or a cough or sneezing, if you can stay home, I would stay home. And if you are in healthcare, I would definitely wear a mask until those things are gone. And hopefully before too long, we'll have better testing availability and we'll be able to just tell who had what.
Dr. Tim Leahy is an infectious disease specialist at the UVM Medical Center. Dr. Leahy, thanks so much for your time today and also everything you're doing behind the scenes to help Vermont meet the challenge.
Sure thing.
Yesterday afternoon, Governor Phil Scott issued an emergency executive order that will result in the closure of all K-12 schools in Vermont by the close of the business day tomorrow. Teachers, parents, employers are all trying to figure out what this transition is going to look like. And VPR reporter John Dillon is fresh from a news conference this morning where Governor Phil Scott addressed some of those concerns. John, a lot of parents are going to be struggling with childcare in the coming weeks. That issue, though, is a particular concern for healthcare workers who right now are on the front lines of the state's response to COVID-19. Phil Scott has said that the state is going to provide childcare options for those healthcare workers. What's the plan to ensure that care exists by Wednesday morning when these school closures are going to take effect?
Well, they're still working on it. Governor Scott today said he recognize the very, very critical nature of healthcare workers needing childcare, needing a place for their kids while they do these critical jobs. He said there isn't a plan yet. They're working on it. They hope to have one in place soon. As he said, quote, "We don't have it perfected, and they hope in the next 2 days to have one." And that window, that this brief 48-hour window that the state and parents and everybody in, with a child in school is scrambling to adjust within, is really critical. And here's Health Commissioner Mark Levine outlining why these next 2 days are so crucial for parents and teachers and the state to prepare.
This was a public health decision to use the school closure as another mitigating strategy. But keep in mind, the reasons that these 48 hours are so critical, some of them are educational. A number of them are public health. We have children who need to be fed, need to have meals. We need that to work seamlessly. We have children, as the governor alluded to, who have disabilities or special needs. Those needs need to be met.
So that was Dr. Mark Levine, the health commissioner, talking about these next 2 days. And as he said, you know, it's not just a public health issue. It's an educational issue and it's a nutrition issue for these kids because a lot of them get fed at schools.
John, I think 40% of the 77,000 students in Vermont are on free and reduced price meal plans. How are districts going to make sure that those kids are well-fed, have adequate nutrition, given the fact that they're no longer going to be getting breakfast and lunch, two of the three meals out of the day that may be the best meals they're getting at school anymore?
Well, they're working on it again. I talked after this news conference with Deputy Education Secretary Heather Boucher on just that question about how the state and the school districts, you know, and we're talking about a huge mix of territory, rural school districts, city school districts, how they're going to meet this challenge. First of all the school employees are going to be paid, including cafeteria workers who are going to be so crucial during this time. And she said basically schools are going to be creative. They're going to come up with a number of ways. One will be grab-and-go lunches and breakfasts, maybe in the same package that parents can pick up. Maybe they'll use the bus system to get these meals out. They also got some rules that require kids to be fed in one place. It's sort of a congregation rule that has been lifted or adjusted so they can do this, these different kinds of meal deliveries. There could be drive-up meals, so you could maintain that social distance that we need to maintain, and parents or whomever could walk up and or drive up and grab a meal. So many, many options, and probably some school districts are going to have a mix of these options.
I know that one of the real concerns right now from lawmakers, teachers, everybody involved in the school system is special needs students. Vermont is required by law to provide an adequate education to these folks. In some instances, though, that means some really intensive one-on-one work in the classroom to make sure that these students' needs are addressed, that they are getting an adequate education. How on earth are districts going to be able to do that when these kids are at home?
Well, again, that's what they're trying to figure out, and that's why I think the governor wanted to take these 2 days to develop at least some start of a contingency plan. You're right. I mean, many of these kids have one-on-one paraeducators who are going to get paid to work on these plans. You know, I asked Heather Boucher, the education deputy education secretary, if she was concerned about education slippage, and that's a real concern because they know that during summertime there's a decline in student performance, and you know, kids just they get a little rusty during those months. So again, Pete, this is just something they're really trying to scramble on in the next 48 hours.
And briefly, John, the governor says schools are shutting down. Learning, though, is not going to stop. We're going to have some remote learning plans. A lot of kids probably live in homes without internet access. Any sense at what that's going to look like?
Yeah, it'll be both online and then sort of educational packets that will be, you know, hard copy that kids can and parents can use at home.
That is VPR reporter John Dillon with the latest from Governor Phil Scott's press briefing this morning. John, thanks for the update.
You're very welcome.